This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 2011 was the ninth warmest year on records, according to a new NASA report, and those records stretch back into the 1880s. And 9 of the 10 warmest years have happened since the year 2000. In other words, it's hotter than ever in modern history, but no data is enough to convince some climate change deniers about global warming. Lawmakers in several states have already introduced laws to make sure the views of climate skeptics are represented in the classroom. Louisiana has already passed one. And as the case with teaching evolution, rather than deal with complaints of parents, some teachers are just avoiding teaching climate change altogether, saying it's more trouble than it's worth. That's where my next guest comes in. Her group, the National Center for Science Education, has defended evolution teaching for decades, and now it's taking on this new challenge to keep good climate science in the classroom and bad science out. Let me introduce her, Eugenia Scott, the Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education in Oakland. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's great to be back.
How widespread is this phenomenon?
We have noticed, of course, every year, as you and I have discussed, there have been a batch of anti-evolution bills submitted to state legislatures. But over the years, we've noticed that many times these anti-evolution bills also bundle global warming along with evolution as allegedly controversial issues that teachers are supposed to give balance to. And we know what that means. You're supposed to teach standard science and then teach anti-science or anti-that particular view. In fact, one was just introduced, we don't even have it up on our website yet, one was just introduced yesterday in Oklahoma that would do this. Mm-hmm. But we're also hearing reports of school boards and local school districts discussing regulations or imposing some sort of restrictions on teachers to teach climate change and climate change denial, basically. And that's obviously something that has a chilling effect. But I think the thing that really motivated us to get into this is the stories that we're hearing from individual teachers more and more frequently, that they are receiving pushback from either students or from parents and, of course, the board of directors that pays their salary in the local school district. And we thought that maybe our experience in dealing with these, really, they're political issues, not really scientific issues so much, on the local level might help teachers cope with these pressures, just as we've attempted to help them over the years cope with pressures against teaching evolution. So, yeah, it's out there, Ira, and it's a problem that we'd like to get ahead of. You know, sometimes I think that the climate change climate change education issue is sort of where evolution was 25 years ago or 25, 30 years ago. And it took us a while to gear up, us being, you know, NCSC, but the science community as well. Maybe we can get ahead of this one and it won't be quite as big a problem.
Right, but evolution was based originally as a religious point of view. You're saying that this is more a political point of view.
That's correct. The commonality is that with the anti-evolution problem that we've been dealing with, yes, you're right, the ideology that motivates it is religious ideology. There's some religious ideology that motivates the anti-global warming group, but it's not really predominant. I mean, there's, you know, God's providence would never let anything bad happen to the earth is out there, but that's not really what's motivating and paying for the surge of anti-global warming and climate change that we've seen recently. It's more a political ideology and or an economic ideology. It's the idea that if the planet's getting warming, if the planet is truly getting warmer, then we're going to have to do something about this, and this is going to require us to make compromises, perhaps in our standard of living. I might lose my job if I'm in a business that's an occupation that has to do with energy production based on carbon, you know, coal, oil, gas, etc. You know, people really have sincere fear is about what's going to happen. And clearly the easiest thing to do is just attack the science. You know, well, the science is invalid. It's not really getting warmer. This is just an effort by liberals to increase big government. You hear that kind of argument out there as well. And so, you know, yes, the science is necessary. You know, yes, we will have to deal with the claim it's just sunspots, or it's just the sun, or it's just normal cyclical kinds of things. It's volcanoes, not human putting CO2 in the air. We're going to have to deal with that. But fundamentally, we're going to have to deal with this, these underlying issues. Just like with evolution, you have to deal with the underlying religious issue and try to assuage some of those concerns. Because, you know, you can't solve this problem by just piling more science on it.
And science teachers are avoiding the whole thing altogether.
We have reason to believe, but it's only anecdotal. There hasn't been a really good survey, a good reliable, you know, standard survey research method type of survey of teachers as to what they know about climate change, climate science, and what they're actually teaching about it. But we have reason to believe anecdotally that many teachers are saying, whoa, this is another controversial issue. I'll just, it's too much work to, you know, I don't want to put up with the crap. I'm just not going to teach it.
We have a lot of people who email us or blog us and say, if I want to answer climate change skeptics, where do I get information? What kind of hard data can I tell them that why I'm convinced of it?
I think a website that I have found very useful and that I recommend to people, and we'll certainly link to it from the resources on NCSE's website, is skepticalscience.com. It's a very useful site. It's written by scientists and knowledgeable people, engineers and the rest. And they have very clear explanations with links, you know, documented scientific research supporting their views for the top 100 or so climate change denialist arguments. So if you want to know whether sunspots are the cause of the global warming, well, they'll explain that very clearly to you, and they actually have, for most of their refutations, they have more than one level. So, you know, here's the basic level and here's the more advanced level, and you click on the more advanced level and you get the 8x10 glossies and a lot more detailed than probably most people actually need. But it's a very useful site. Mm-hmm. And there are other sites also. The Smog Blog is another one that refutes many of the arguments. So the refutations are out there. Mm-hmm. It's not going. And NCSE is not going to have a lot of that information on our site. We'll have some of it, just, you know, basic stuff. But we will link. We will provide links to good scientific responses to the claims of the global warming deniers.
Well, Dr. Scott, thank you, Eugenie, for coming on and talk with us.
More than happy to. Thanks so much for helping us get out the word that we're here to help on this topic as well as evolution.
Dr. Eugenie Scott is Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education that's based in Oakland, California.
Now to technology unlocking the ivory tower. NPR's Steve Henn takes us to Stanford, where professors are making classes available online to thousands.
Last semester, Sebastian Thrun, who helped build a self-driving car for Google, got together with a small group of other Stanford computer science professors, and pretty impulsively, they decided to open their Stanford classes to the world and allow anyone, anywhere, to attend online for free, take quizzes, ask questions, even get grades. They made this announcement with almost no fanfare, sending out a single email to a professional group.
Within hours, we had 5,000 students sign up. That was on a Saturday morning, and Sunday night we had 10,000 students.
Eventually, more than 160,000 students signed up for Thrun's class with Peter Norvig on artificial intelligence, or AI.
We reached many more students, Peter and I, in this one class than all other AI professors combined reached in the last year.
People from 190 countries signed up. Students from the Australian outback, Shanghai, Africa, the Ukraine, and all over the United States studied together online. After it was over, videos offering thanks flooded in.
My name is Jack
Hello.
Wise.
My name is Melody Bliss.
Hi, my name is Bill Fogunshola.
Hi, my name is Janine Cohen.
I'm from Tallahassee, Florida.
First of Lagos, Nigeria.
all of these students and tens of thousands of others completed the class.
I teach math, science, robotics, and computer technology at a
I am a disabled woman going through dialysis 3 times a week.
I'm 16 years old.
They took the same class Stanford students took, and they got grades. But they didn't pay a cent, and they didn't get credit. Jim Plummer's the dean of engineering.
I think it will actually be a long time, maybe never, when actual Stanford degrees would be given for fully online work by anyone who wished to register for the courses.
Stanford does give degrees for online work, but only to students who get through the admissions process and pay, often $40,000 or $50,000 for a master's degree. But technology could push prices down.
On the long term, I think the potential for this to revolutionize education is just tremendous.
Daphne Kohler is a computer science professor at Stanford and a MacArthur Genius Fellow. She's been working to make online education more engaging and interactive for years.
There are millions of people around the world that have access only to the poorest quality of education or sometimes nothing at all.
Kohler says technology could change that. She says it makes it possible in many subjects to teach classes with 100,000 students as easily and almost as cheaply as a class that has just 100 students. And if you look around the world, the demand for education in places like South Africa is enormous.
In the University of Johannesburg, a few weeks ago, they had a very small number of places that was still open. And so there were thousands of people parked outside the gate, sitting there for the gates to open so they could be first in line to register for that limited number of slots. And when the gates opened, there was a stampede.
20 people were injured, and one woman was killed. Kohler hopes in the future, technology will make these kinds of tragedies preventable. In this semester, Stanford will put 17 interactive courses online for free. Over the last 6 months, Sebastian Thrun has spent roughly $200,000 of his own money and lined up venture capital to create a new online institution of higher learning, independent of Stanford.
The name is Udacity. We are committed to free online education for everybody.
Udacity is announcing two new classes today. One will teach students to build their own search engine. Another, how to program a self-driving car. Eventually, the founders hope to offer a full slate of classes in computer science, all for free. Thrun believes Stanford's mission is really to attract the top 1% of students from all over the world and bring them to campus. He says Udacity's mission is different. Free, quality education for all, anywhere. A sweeping, disruptive technology. Here's Daphne Kohler.
What I think is clear is that this change is coming, and it's coming whether we like it or not. And so I think the right strategy is to embrace that change.
Over the years, Stanford has launched dozens of disruptive technologies into the world. But now administrators and professors here seem to agree it could be about to disrupt itself. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
The federal government has come out with its new standards for school meals: less fat, less salt, less sugar, and more fruits, grains, and vegetables. Devin Katayama from member station WFPL reports on how the Louisville, Kentucky school district is trying to comply with the guidelines and satisfy student tastes.
Meet fourth grade food critic Jackson Schleff.
With the spaghetti sauce and the spaghetti, I'd say it does need a little more chunks of vegetable, ones that you can see fairly well.
He's reviewing that school cafeteria standby, spaghetti, but it's spaghetti with healthier ingredients and less salt. Jackson is one of 8 students on the Nutrition Advisory Council for Jefferson County Public Schools. The student group meets 4 times a year to taste new breakfasts and lunch meals, and a bad review from this group is enough to block a new recipe from being served to their schoolmates throughout Louisville, Kentucky. Julia Bauscher is the district's nutrition director. She says having students evaluate changes to the menu has already improved school nutrition. But the problem with the way kids eat, she says, extends beyond the school cafeteria.
It's not just schools that have to change what they're doing. It's our entire community, everyone, because I can serve them healthy food and I can only offer healthy choices, whoever defines what that is, because healthy choices are different for different people. But if the kids don't eat it, what have I accomplished?
The federal guidelines announced yesterday call for a gradual reduction in sodium in school meals. Bauscher says even that gradual reduction will be hard to achieve.
American palates are so accustomed to high sodium content that when you lower sodium, students don't like it as much.
And what students don't like, they won't eat. To help introduce students to a variety of foods that are healthy and tasty, Jefferson County brought in a new chef, Jim Whaley.
These are some locally sourced apples, and I'm dehydrating these, and we're going to take these to some of the fresh fruit and vegetable schools and let the students sample another way to eat fresh fruits.
Of course, this isn't the only school district promoting healthy eating and trying to win student approval. The Los Angeles Unified School District recently revamped its menu and made it dramatically healthier. Schools offered meals like vegetable curry and lentil and brown rice cutlets, but thousands of students stopped eating school lunches and gave a thumbs down to many of the new dishes. It's Jim Whaley's job to figure out the best balance between flavor, nutritional value, and the operational demands of serving 90,000 meals daily. It's not easy. For now, there are still some less healthful options on the school menu. And according to our 10-year-old critic, Jackson Schleff, there's no shortage of demand.
The more popular items that I see are in the morning would be the cinnamon rolls, and during the lunchtime, it would be the pizza or the chicken nuggets.
Whaley insists that changing the culinary culture of the cafeteria is possible. He's confident the new spaghetti sauce he's working on, locally sourced, low in sodium and rich in vegetables, will eventually win over his grade school diners. It just may take a while. For NPR News, I'm Devin Kadiyama in Louisville.
Nutrition experts seem to agree the new lunch regulations are great as far as they're concerned, but certainly not perfect.
For one thing, Congress blocked an effort to limit how often kids are served starchy foods like French fries.
Maybe the healthiest option is simply to bring a lunch. So we asked listeners on Facebook what kids are carrying in their lunch boxes, and we heard everything from lentil soup to leftovers of mustard-crusted lamb.
Although after hearing all that variety, it was almost reassuring to learn that many kids still carry in a sandwich, like peanut butter and jelly.
Sandwiches are beautiful, sandwiches are fine. I like sandwiches, I eat them all the time. I eat them for my supper and I eat them for my lunch. If I had 100 sandwiches, I'd eat them all at once.